Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prishkintas.
We gather here once a week in the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donald in the Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or just call a pub and ask for Marcus.
It's turning into fall. Everybody's got their sweaters out, more or less, or at least know where they are. And a little windy and cool today, and the leaves are blowing around. And, Donna, what do you have for us today? Kind of fallish sort of theme.
Yeah, well, of course, the first thing you do when the weather goes like this is you get out the soup pot, right?
We do.
People are making chili, or I made a big lentil soup the other night with lots of garlic in it, because if you're not careful, the change of weather will get you the snuffles. You know, we're just not quite ready for this. So I was thinking one of the things that's really nice, and, you know, soup naturally comes to mind, but the other thing that goes well with chili and soups is cornbread. And it's something that's so easy to make. We forget, you know, we just kind of get out of, think, oh, baking is a big deal. Or, you know, but this one is, you turn on your oven because it's kind of takes the chill out of there anyway, right?
Very good.
So I just use the Joy of Cooking recipe, but I use local corn flour from early morning harvest, which makes all the difference. After all, we do have corn here in Iowa. Most of it is not exactly humanly edible, but there are a few nice farmers that are growing really good eating corn, not like the sweet corn. So early morning harvest, which you can purchase locally and Wheatsfield probably. Also, Farm to Folk. For those of you who don't know Farm to Folk, it is an online early ordering process, and then you pick it up once a week at the First Methodist Church downtown. You can Google that, Farm to Folk. They have the full line of all the early morning harvest products, like their nice wheat flour. So the standard recipe that I use is in the Joy of Cooking, you know. And all I add to it, of course I can't leave the recipe changed. I add some coriander and some marjoram, and that just gives it a nice little kick. And if you're feeling really adventurous, you might put a little chili pepper in it or something. And, of course, you can change the fats. You can use butter. You can use bacon grease. You can use lard. You can actually use olive oil, too. And one of the nice tricks, and they do talk about this in The Joy of Cooking, is if you make it in the cast iron skillet and you preheat some oil or butter or bacon fat or lard, so the skillet is full of hot oil, and you pour that batter right into the sizzling oil and then set it into the, I mean, you can either melt it in the oven so the pan is hot that way, or you can just start it on the stovetop. And then, but the point is, when that batter hits that sizzling grease, you're going to get a really nice crispy crust. And I just think there's nothing quite as nice as cornbread and soup, you know?
Sounds like fall to me.
Yeah, it does. It does. And the other autumnal specialty that I'm enjoying a lot this year is black walnuts. Now, sometimes they have them at Hy-Vee. Where else do we buy them? You kind of got to ask around. Everybody has black walnuts. I hardly know anybody that, you know, you can walk down your neighborhood block and
we trip over them.
Is going to have a tree, but they are just the dickens to get out of the shell. So, but there are a few people who like the tenacity of that, and it's kind of a sport. And if you can find black walnuts, now it's a flavor. I mean, I grew up with it as a child and did not love it, though my mother loved it. So it was a kind of an adult flavor in my early life. We used to call what everybody now calls a walnut, we used to call that, oh, that's the English walnut. And then the black walnut is what we grow here in Iowa. And it has a like more bitter, dark flavor. So today I brought some biscotti in that I made with black walnuts and chocolate chips. Here's a little trick for introducing black walnuts to people. Put it with chocolate. Somehow with the chocolate, the black walnuts just taste really joyful. Like I make a black walnut fudge or as simple as a black walnut chocolate chip cookie. It's, you know, it's a nice, I mean, you can eat them all year round, but I really like to eat them in the fall. So I think our biscotti recipe is posted on our website recipe. So, and with the biscotti, you can, you know, change the flavoring any way you like. Sometimes I use, like, walnuts. Sometimes I use pecans. Sometimes I use almonds or raisins or anything. Anybody want to give it a description of the taste of these black walnut chocolate biscotti?
Lovely. You've got... Did you put pepper in there?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Just cinnamon, pepper, and vanilla, I think. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I think I did put coriander in it. You know me, I have to put coriander and pepper in everything. But it's under... I like a little pepper in my sweets, you know? Black pepper.
Yeah.
Just black pepper.
The first woman I ever met that put black pepper in just about everything, including her baked goods, and it's good.
Here's where I learned the trick.
Okay.
Maybe 30 years ago, there's a way of serving fresh strawberries that's very Italian where you just cut them up, you put a little sugar to macerate, a splash of balsamic vinegar, and a little black pepper.
Aha.
So once I did that, I was all in for the black pepper in the sweets.
Good.
Yeah.
Good
job. Adds a little undercurrent to everything.
Mm-hmm. You've done it again. Mm-hmm. Thoughts of cornbread, thoughts of black walnut. Well, and so we have thoughts of fall, and we have a special guest with us today, Ben Hawk. He is a forager, a citizen of the prairie. He knows Iowa pretty darn well from the outside in. Welcome to our table, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me. I think I've been called worse than that, but I'll take it.
That's good. Well, how would you identify yourself?
No, I think that was a very apt description.
Well, that's very good. Well, you make your existence by kind of being familiar with what's out in the natural world. You forage, you gather things. What are you finding in the woods and prairies right about now?
Well, I guess right off the bat, we got a frost coming up here pretty quick, and there's a few species.
A heavy one.
And there's a few species of mushrooms that are out right now that if we do get those temperatures that are in the mid-20s, they're going to get kind of damaged, and they're not going to be too good for market or for personal use anymore. So I'm going to be chasing some of those down. If you're on the bike trails around Ames or pretty much anywhere in the state of Iowa, if you're familiar with a tree called the box elder, they're kind of people call them kind of a weedy species. They'll be along streams or creeks or kind of foregone places. And this time of year, there is a mushroom called the elm oyster. Now, this mushroom doesn't usually grow on elms, and it's not an oyster mushroom. So it's the genius of common names. But they grow almost specifically out of the knot holes on box elder trees this time of year.
What an ecological niche that is. Something that grows in the knot hole of a box elder tree.
Very good.
Yeah, they're a big, pretty white mushroom with a centrally located stalk. And if you know a box elder tree and you know that little fact, feel free to walk out and eat some of those.
So that means they're kind of higher up off the...
Oh, yeah. I'm bringing a stick with a knife duct tape to it. And it's good to have a second person to catch so, you know, you don't get into trouble there. But...
Good.
You can be resourceful.
What kind of mushrooms are you finding? They're quite beautiful. Wow.
Yeah, they're very firm. They're really nice for cooking or for stews. They hold up very well.
Yeah, and it looks like you can get them clustered, so it's not like one and then another one.
Well, the first images on Google are usually the ideal ones, right?
Oh, okay.
So we've got another species that's out right now. It's called the velvet foot. Now, this mushroom is most commonly seen in the stores, and it's sold as a Japanese under the Japanese name enoki.
Oh, it's called a velvet foot, and enoki is?
Yeah, so enokis are the same species, Flamulina vulpes, I think it is, as the enoki mushroom is the same as the velvet foot. Excuse me. So
now those grow in clumps too, right? Because they're teeny weeny.
They do grow in clumps, but the thing is, when you buy them in the store, they grow them in really high CO2 environments and in pitch black. And when they do that, they grow really tall and skinny, and they stay white. Now, when you find them outside, you find them in big clusters, usually on the outside of elm trees. Now, these things are called the winter mushrooms as well, because you can find them pretty much straight through the winter if you have warm-ups for 3 or 4 or 5 days. They're one of the last edible mushrooms to be fruiting in Iowa.
Are they teeny weeny though?
No, they can get fairly large. You know, they can be the caps can be the size of a 50-cent piece or even bigger. The thing is,
so they don't look anything at all like what you buy at the supermarket.
If you peel back the bark from where the ones that are growing on the outside of the tree, you know, they're going to be bright orange with kind of a velvety purple kind of stem towards the base specifically. You pull back the bark on that tree, you can find those tiny, skinny white ones that you usually recognize in the store. So people, you know, have learned to cultivate mushrooms in different ways to get them to look or taste how they want. And that's what we're doing with the velvet foot.
Oh, very good. So there's still stuff to gather, still stuff to eat. I've been hearing, Ben checks in every now and then, and I've been hearing about this project for most of the summer. You've been looking for a clean farm pond in Iowa. Good luck. And
you are very scarce, right? As hen's teeth, as my mother used to say.
Mm-hmm. But you are actually farming this pond. What is going on in the pond?
Yeah, so I found a pond in northeast of here.
The only clean pond in the state, right?
The only clean pond in the state. The entire watershed is CRP and woodlands, from what I understand. And I went and nosed around in there and swam around in the muck and mud this summer and kind of felt the bottom out and went and decided that I was going to start farming a native plant.
How deep is it?
The pond ranges from 10 feet to, you know, 1 foot at the shore. And I'll get into the life history of the plant here in a little bit. I'm talking about a native perennial plant called American lotus. And American lotus is related to, you know, the Asian species lotus that you can commonly find in Asian cooking. You know, maybe not so much, but if you go to the Asian market here in Ames.
Is it like a lily pad that floats on the surface?
Yeah. So if you go to the Asian market here in Ames, you can actually buy the Asian variety for like $2.50 a pound. But what it is, it's an aquatic plant. The root structures grow in the mud, and then they make these long, shoots that come up and make really large lily pads. In the summer and early fall, they've got nice, pretty white or yellow flowers. And then you may recognize the seed heads from flower arrangements. They're kind of like those little brown, rattly shower head looking deals that kind of stick up and look at you. And they are just an amazing food source. They're kind of hard to get at unless you've got, unless you can hold your breath for a little while and feel like getting shoulder deep in mud. But they are very starchy. They're very attractive. They dry. They cook up purple or pink, and they dry and rehydrate very well. And not to mention, you plant them once, and you never have to do anything again. There's no tilling. There's no fertilizing.
Well,
there's no rotation.
Even if you're digging up the tuber.
Yeah, so these guys are extremely,
so it's like
they're extremely aggressive.
They make lots of them. Then
it's like daylilies. So don't plant them where you don't want them.
And how deep into the muck in the bottom of the pond do you have to go?
So that's all dependent on the type of soil that you have. Ideally, it's very, very easy digging. But when it's easy digging, they go deep. So you may have to go like 3 feet down to find them.
So let me get this right. You're in the bottom of the pond, swimming there, no gear, just your hands and maybe a knife or something?
No knife.
Oh, you just running through the muck with your fingers in the bottom of the pond till you grab and pull?
So in the late summer and early fall, even through the winter and spring, if you're feeling brave enough or you've got a wetsuit, what you do is you wait for those plants. They're going to start to go dormant. They're going to make next year's tubers to be able to, you know, grow and make a lily pad again next year. So what you do is you follow those stems down from the lily pads all the way down into the mud. And then depending on how, you know, deep the root structure is, you can go down like a 6 or 8 inches, and then the plant is just going to branch off and go off in every different direction. They're extremely rhizomatous. They send a bunch of runners, you know, all over the place.
And about how big is this? Like a fist?
So the runners are about the size of your finger, and those are just networks of underground roots. And basically, those will be anywhere from 6 inches to 2 feet underneath the surface of the mud. And you basically need to follow those horizontally along. Parallel with the muddy bottom, and then you'll be following it, and all of a sudden you'll end up hitting another stem, and it'll turn into a lily pad. You go, well, that's not one. So you go back to the beginning, and you start over, and you start following that root again, and you'll be following it, and just about the time you're ready to give up, that root's going to take a dive, and it's going to go down another 6 inches to foot or maybe more. But when you know it's diving, that's when you know you've got a big tuber underneath it. Now, these things are also called mud bananas. They basically look like a giant plantain. You know, they can be as much as 2 pounds, or they can be as small as just one of those little red bananas that you get at the store. And they can grow in chains of 2, 3, or even 4. So you get down there and you kind of start feeling around and you find them and you realize you've got one tuber, and then you've got to reach in and feel more, and you're kind of just digging with your one hand along the side.
You're holding your breath under the bottom of the water, right?
Yep. So if you don't get it on your first go, you've got to jump back up and get another breath and go back down.
Do you keep yourself down there by holding on to the roots or something? I mean,
yeah. So I'll just bury a hand into the mud and that'll keep me down there. But it's an amazing.
Do you wear a water headlamp or anything, or it's all by feel?
Oh, it's all by feel. Yeah, you're stirring up so much mud down there, you wouldn't be able
to see anything.
Yeah, but it's a great family activity. I mean, even these in like 5 or 6 feet of water, you can still get them. But you can get them in 2 feet of water too. And imagine getting a group of people out there and digging around in the mud on like one of the last hot days of the summer or the fall, and you know, being able to pull a bunch of stuff out. Now this sounds a little more appealing.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, think of people have been digging clams and things for a long time.
Right.
Well, and if you talked about what you had to go
through.
Yeah, but
they use shovels.
Yeah. Well, you know, but it still sounds kind of icky. Now, this is a very Iowa thing.
No, the ick doesn't bother me. Oh. It's trying to do that while you're holding your breath 10 feet under. 2 feet, I think.
Well, 10, I mean, yeah, not 10 feet, but I get it.
Ben is a tall person, so it's a,
yeah. Well, if anyone has ever been out to the Amana Colonies, they call it the lily pond out there.
Yes.
But it's actually not a lily by any means. It's an American lotus. You know, it's a food crop that the history of the lily pond isn't quite known, but it's one conjecture is that that was actually planted by natives when the lake was created about 100 years ago.
And Iowa was full of prairie potholes, which would have been an environment for that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, not really prairie potholes. They kind of need slow-moving water.
They need some movement.
So if you go out to the Mississippi River on the backwaters, there's tens of thousands of acres of this stuff. There's more food than you could ever harvest in your life out there. And natives made great use of it. Yeah, I'm hoping to do the same.
Now, didn't you cook a bunch of those for us one time?
Yeah, we had it last
spring. You did a big stir fry of them. And first of all, they're beautiful because you cut them with a cross section, and I don't know how to describe what it looks like. It's like a potato that has polka dots cut out in it or something.
It's like a pinwheel or a Ferris wheel.
It's very pretty. It's not as soft. It has a little more crunch than a potato.
Yep.
But it has that same. You know how a potato can carry all kinds of other flavors? So you just sautéed them with what?
I think I just did some butter, and then I had some spruce tip salt that I put on them.
Yeah, they were really good.
Oh, so
really
good.
My favorite thing to do is make hash browns with them.
Ha!
Ah, see, very good. And you had the idea of not just kind of foraging for these, but planting them on purpose. Talk about the size and how much you are farming right now in this pond.
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure on the size of the pond. It's maybe about an acre. Mm-hmm. So I went out and harvested roots from several locations this early fall, and then went into this pond and just dug them in as deep as I could. And luckily, the landowner was okay with the idea, and knowing that from the day I put lotus in his pond, there will always be lotus in the pond. So you want to be sure, if you are going to try to do something like this yourself, to be like cautious of where your pond is connected to. You know, if your pond flows directly into a public lake or a public pond of some sort, you know, they can move. They're not going to be too big of an issue in our rivers or streams. You know, they used to occur here, but our hydrology has been so altered that they can't exist in those places anymore. So I'm hoping in 3 years I'll have crops that are good enough to harvest. And then at the same time, I want to host events out there where I teach people how to do this and kind of have a U-pick lotus situation.
Oh, well, do call us when that happens.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Set you up a couple lawn chairs under the sumac and yeah.
Now, see, there's a lot of things that can grow in Iowa, and we farm a lot of different things.
And those are native, right?
They are native, yeah.
You just kind of encourage. It's like push and pull, and pull the stuff and push it, the stuff that you do want.
We didn't ask what the nutritive value is. Do you know?
I really never research any of that stuff.
You just eat it.
Yeah, I just figure if it's diversity, it's different than I'm eating right now. I'm pretty cool with it.
Well, we can report that he looks strong and healthy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's doing just fine. We'll come back to talk to Ben more about some of his adventures, but I'm going to take this opportunity to mention this is KHOI 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. We are talking about foraging and lotus farming in an Iowa farm pond of all things. We are here with Ben Hawks. He is a forager and an all-around good person to know when it comes to good things to eat. Donna, you mentioned something that you read about lotus in general.
I remember in my days of examining macrobiotic, food traditions and things like that, because lotus root is very common in Chinese food. In fact, you can probably buy them in Chinese stores, I'm sure, dried or frozen or fresh. But it was recommended for ailments of the chest and breathing system. So must have an affinity for that.
Hmm. Well, after all that digging and hard breathing, it'd be good to good to have something for it.
Yeah. That's good. So are you going to be investing in, like, a wetsuit and snorkels and things like that?
No snorkel, but I do have a wetsuit from time surfing out in the West Coast. So I actually used that this year during some of the harvests.
Yeah.
And I may get back out again this fall or maybe early spring to a few locations, dig some more. Depends on how brave I want to be.
It's amazing to think of. I'd just go underneath just to see what the heck is going on down there.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting people involved, you know, like you know, I could excavate a whole root system and then we can have people in the water and, you know, be able to see how it grows and, you know, kind of feel your way through it. And the food is just, it's a delicious food product. You know, there's chefs I've brought these to in the past. They're excited to be able to buy them. And the same goes for all
right,
the
they
other.
They have a fairly neutral flavor and they're very interesting looking.
Yeah, definitely. And they have a fairly neutral flavor. You know, as much as a potato has a flavor, you know, these guys have their own kind of unique potato take. Early in the season, they're kind of pinkish when you cook them. They're more water chestnut in texture, and you can eat them fresh. Later in the season, they do get a lot more starchy, and they get almost purple when you cook them. So different techniques for different times of year.
You always are a source of interesting things. You gave me some seeds early last spring.
Yeah.
And I plant these, he says. And so I did. And it needs something to climb on, you say. So tell me. And it worked. It worked. I got a plant and I got some fruit. Tell me about it. What was that?
So I spent last fall and winter hitchhiking around the country for about 5 months, and I kind of have a habit of finding random seeds and smearing them in my journal, and then when I get home the next year, forgetting about them until the spring. I ended up with a variety of tomato that way that I still like to grow. And this trip, it was this Guadalupe cucumber, which is a native plant to the southern United States. And it's in the cucumber family. It basically looks like a cucumber vine, but super, super tiny. The vines are very, very stringy. You know, they're only big around as a piece of spaghetti.
And did it ever look like something I should pull up? I thought, oh, my goodness, this can't be right. I think I even pulled up some, but it was so vigorous. Teeny, tiny, lacy, beautiful little vine.
Yeah, and, you know, pretty little flowers, and then it starts making these fruits pretty late in the season, actually. Didn't really start making fruits until the heat of the summer and getting on to fall. But they look like tiny cucumbers or tiny watermelons. You know, they're basically just like the size
of your fingernail size or something?
Yeah, like your pinky nail. They're super small.
Wow, really small.
But lots of them.
Yeah, lots of them. They've got a nice tangy flavor. You want to eat them when they're green, when they ripen to raw. Yep.
Raw.
Or you could imagine like pickling them would be really fun. You know, they're almost size of a large caper, you know.
Capers, yes. Yeah.
Oh.
But you eat them when they're green, and if you eat them when they're ripe, they turn kind of purplish black. They can have a bit of a laxative effect. So.
Yeah. I thank you for telling me that. But yes, they do change color, and tasting them green, they're really refreshing little thing. I don't. You said it's from the southern United States. I wonder if they'll
Southwest, right?
Well, they range from Florida all the way to Texas, if I remember right.
And oh, then, so it's not a desert plant.
No, it's not a desert plant. And they do go south into Mexico and whatnot. They've got a very, very wide range.
And you said the Latin name. It has a funny, what is it?
I think it's Melothyra pendula. So that's kind of
we'll stick with Guadalupe cucumber.
Yeah. I think you can get seeds for them online and whatnot. There's a few chefs in the Des Moines area that are interested in me growing more of it for next year.
And how would they use it?
I don't know if they just use them as
a garnish.
Or they'd just throw them in some vinegar for a couple of days and give them a nice little tang on top of what they've got.
Or put a toothpick in it and put it in a martini, perhaps.
Yeah, there
you go. There you go. Very good.
Imagine if you had enough of them, you could blend them up and even make a pretty interesting sauce with it.
Oh, I know, but that'd be such a waste of the visual aspect of
them. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, they're really...
That's why I'm not a chef. I just grow the stuff. Or pick the stuff.
Here. That's good. You've been you've been gathering and identifying, and you've been taking this stuff to chefs for quite a few years. Was it hard to get people interested in these... unconventional foods?
No, they're exceptionally excited about it. You know, in a place like central Iowa here, you know, there is a market for high-end food and, you know, local food and people doing really unique creative things. There's some very creative chefs out there. And a lot of these folks came from places like Chicago or the Kansas City or L.A. or New York or spend time in these larger cities where they had access to a lot of these unique ingredients, or they may have had access to people who foraged and, you know, made an effort to get into the city to sell things to these chefs. So when I come in, you know, before I can establish a relationship with one of these people, it's me knocking on the back door, you know, next to the grease trap, you know, in between 2 and 4 o'clock, hoping to find a sous chef smoking a cigarette or something.
Right, when they're not busy.
Yeah, to be able to go, hey, my name is Ben, I'm a forager, and I've got this big box of stuff. Is your chef around? And they usually kind of look at me kind of weird, and then I pull the cover off of the box, and it's full of beautiful mushrooms and fresh greens, and they go, oh, come in, come in, come in. And yeah, you know, some of the folks will buy from you one time and never do it again. And other times, you know, you'll end up becoming friends with them, and it's pretty neat to be able to see how those relationships go.
Chef is always looking for some ingredient that he can't find readily, so he has something that, well, first of all, it's your curiosity gets you, and then it's, you know, you don't want to cook the. It's like giving the artist a new color on his palette, you know?
Yeah, nice.
It's a new flavor profile, a new texture. Oh, what do we do with this? What might it. You know, it just sparks your creativity, and it's fun.
Yeah, there was one last year that I brought to a chef that he was super excited about, and I didn't know this until this year when I couldn't find any, but they very rarely make fruit in large numbers. This is a brush called prickly ash that grows in Iowa, and it grows along the transitions of woodlands and prairies and fence lines. And if you're a hunter in the fall and walking through this time of year, it could be something that can even poke you right through your Carhartts. So folks are usually battling this one, but it's actually Iowa's only wild member of the native member of the citrus family. And it's directly related to the same genus as Szechuan peppercorns.
So is it numbing?
It is exceptionally numbing.
And what's it called?
It's called prickly ash.
Prickly ash. Is it a fruit? What's it look like?
So it's a short shrub that can maybe get 10 feet tall max. You know, I usually find them around 6 foot tall. The fruits are in these little kind of hard capsules. When they're unripe, they go from like kind of green and they start to turn red. And then inside of those capsules, which are a little fleshy later in the year, there's a dark black seed. And you usually get rid of the dark black seed because it's kind of grainy. You know, it's kind of like you got a little bit of sand in what you got going on.
So you're going for the fleshy part?
So you're going for the fleshy part. And you want to harvest them early enough in the season to where the seed capsules will rupture and the black seed can fall out. But not so late in the year that they've already all ruptured
and dried out
and they're not as flavorful.
So what do you end up with, a paste then that you mix into the food that's like a pepper?
You end up with just this hard seed capsule.
Hard.
Once they're dried, they're pretty tough. And then folks will blend them into a powder.
Grind them, yeah.
Grind them and use them. One of the chefs I was selling to was using them in a rabbit
dish. Somebody
who
has never eaten a Szechuan peppercorn, and there probably are many of us, it's spicy a little bit while you're eating it, and then all of a sudden, if you've eaten enough of it, you realize that your tongue feels a little weird. It numbs your tongue. Not like at the dentist, that kind of, but definitely a sensation. And I brought some back from China once because there was a period, I don't know, maybe it was 10 years ago, where it was actually illegal to import them.
Ooh.
But now you can
Rebel.
Get them. Yeah. So it's called Szechuan peppercorn.
Szechuan, yeah.
Yeah.
So what did the chef do with the prickly ash?
He used them in a rabbit dish.
Rabbit?
Yeah, he was really excited.
Did you bring him the rabbit, too?
I did not. Can't sell wild game in Iowa.
Oh, very good.
But they're cool. It's also called the toothache tree. And there's a fella I know called Kenny Solway, who's got some cool books out there, one being The Last River Rat and whatnot. But I remember him telling a story about used to harvest and sell the bark to be sold in toothache remedies.
Was that because it numbs?
It's got a numbing effect.
Like also clove will do the same thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Clove oil, yeah. Those are the old toothache remedies.
Prickly ash.
Huh.
Oh, and did you find any pawpaws this year?
I did. I picked about 200 pounds of pawpaws this year.
Oh, no. What did you do with 200 pounds of pawpaws?
Well, I gave some away. I sold some to friends. I sold some to a brewery. They made an IPA out of them. And Yeah, I traveled up and down the Missouri River Corridor on some private land of people that I know and found an abundance of fruit. I'm going to be planting a bunch of the seeds around Ames. So in 10 years, if you start seeing pawpaws in random places,
so this is the most northern territory, though, for pawpaws.
Yeah, it is. The Highway 30 is kind of like the generally accepted north-south line for pawpaw tolerance, you know, in Iowa. They can grow north of Highway 30, but they have a really hard time producing fruit because it takes so long for them to ripen.
So now a pawpaw, they're kind of light yellow colored, right? Or the flesh is.
Yep.
They're mushy.
Yep.
The only thing I've ever done, and they have seeds in them too. You have to get the seeds out. The only thing I've ever done with them is make an ice cream.
Ice cream is great. You can substitute pawpaw, you know, the mush for bananas to make a pawpaw bread, which has been pretty good.
Does it lose its flavor as you cook it?
I mean, I guess like anything that would lose some flavor as it's heated, but it still has its own unique kind of tang.
It does. It's not – I don't know. I wouldn't call it a tang. It's very – it's a very subtle kind of sweetness even in the ice cream.
Hmm.
Almost has like a tutti frutti flavor to it, you know?
Tutti frutti, but not tang. All right.
Yeah. Well, you know, tang implies a little more acid than I think that it has.
And okay.
It's very good.
Are they related to cherimoyas, the tropical cherimoya?
I don't know.
They have that same kind of mushy, seeded interior.
Custardy.
Custardy. Custardy.
That's a much nicer word
than mushy.
Radio.
Yeah. Mushy. Custardy. They're very custardy.
Yeah, that's good. So there's all kind, and yes, they're growing here in the Midwest. I was recently at a apple cider pressing, and I was given a cup to taste, and I had a really interesting experience because this apple cider had something in it. What did you do to that?
Yeah, so I've got a hand crank press I bought a few years ago and tried to get people together. And we had kind of a late night of grinding apples, you know. Sometimes you get a little creative after a few hours of pressing. And we had a big box of peppers that was next to us. So we decided to – one of the women who I was with –
hot pepper?
Decided to grab a handful of hot peppers and throw them into the grinder along with all the apples. And tell you what, you know, instant mold cider, like it's just, and you put just enough in it to where it's like a nice warming effect, like it tastes.
What kind of pepper did you use?
Oh my God, we use this little red one and this bigger orange, funky looking one.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Definitely a kick to them. We only put, you know, maybe 7 or 8 peppers in the whole, you know, 5-gallon batch of cider that we made. So they
sounds like a good combination. You know, that sweet and heat kind of thing is.
There's so much good things out there, and so many things to enjoy and explore. I'm going to share a poem with you here. It's about. Some people are very comfortable in the natural world, and some people aren't. Some people get a little edgy out there among the trees. And here is for those that might feel a little apprehension. This is called Lost by a poet named David Wagner. Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen, it answers, I've made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again and say, here. No two trees are the same to the raven. No two branches are the same to the wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. This is a poem named Lost by David Wagner. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thank you.
back talking about foraging for wild things in Iowa with Ben. Ben, what's next? What are you out to gather now?
Well, I'm not too sure on the gathering part. I'm going to do some scouting. So one of the things whenever I talk about foraging is I usually get a couple of people whose eyes light up and they've seen some Appalachian TV show dramatized thing from Discovery Channel. And do you dig ginseng? It's like, well, no, I'm not really, you know, it's a delicate thing. It's a rare plant. You know, if you dig roots, you kill the whole thing. You know, when I think of foraging, I like to take flowers or fruits or shoots or leaves, you know, things that don't leave a big impact. Mushrooms, in fact, are a very low impact. The whole mushroom is just like an apple, and the whole tree is buried underground. So you can pick as many mushrooms as you want as long as they go to maturity. You can still release some spores. You're really not going to be doing much of any damage there. But ginseng is a little different.
Well, and ginseng has a high market value, especially American ginseng. So it could easily be taken by greedy people.
Yeah, and almost every year in Iowa, there's someone who gets arrested for, you know, going onto public land and harvesting this plant because it's not legal to harvest this from public land. You're not allowed to take any roots, in fact, from public land.
Is that because it's so endangered?
It's because it's so endangered. It's because it's easily exploited. And because on public land in Iowa, you know, it's kind of there for the people. You're allowed to harvest nuts, fruits, mushrooms and asparagus on public land in Iowa, unless it's a state preserve or there's special regulations out there. There are some pieces of public land I've visited in Wisconsin, though, that are specifically for foraging. So
Really? You
can take whatever you want when you what you encounter out there, which is a pretty cool idea. But today I'm going up to meet up with an old timer who has a couple of spots that he used to go visit, and I am interested in kind of assessing the population of ginseng there and seeing if it would be okay to make a harvest, preferably for personal use, or if there's enough and the landowner wants to make a little bit of money to kind of help him make a farm payment and make sure that the plant stays in good abundance for future.
It can be cultivated, right?
Yeah, definitely. The cultivated...
it takes a while.
Yep. So it depends on what you mean by cultivate. You know, some folks will grow them in, you know, pretty intensive setups with artificial shade. But the way they grow in those situations, you know, people who've done it for a long time can kind of tell the difference between the roots that have eked out a living on a north slope versus ones that have been grown under shade and better soil. So the ones that are truly wild, you know, growing in the woods are worth a little bit more.
Well, I suppose the tough ones, like when you stress a wine vine, for example, they probably, well, traditionally they have much more value because their pharmacological properties are stronger.
Yeah, definitely.
And the older the root, the more, well, the bigger it is, but the actual more value it has in the market, too.
Yeah, so I'm interested to get out to this piece of property and see, you know, if it is in fact ginseng to start with, and then to kind of assess the population and see what the landowner wants to do. You know, this would be the first time that I've ever considered, you know, harvesting a plant. But in the state of Iowa, you know, if you are going to be harvesting ginseng, as far as I'm aware, even on private land, you do need a permit to sell the root yourself. So it's not one of those things I encourage people to go out and dig. You know, there's a few patches on public land that I do visit every year. I check on how they're spreading. You know, I may accidentally get some seeds that are stuck in my shoe, and I may walk a little bit, and they may fall out my shoe a little bit farther down the trail, you know, and it's nice to see those patches spread when they can. Yeah, I'm curious to see if it is, in fact, the rare American ginseng in the state of Iowa.
Well, best of luck in your hunt.
I appreciate it.
Good, good. Thank you for being with us today. All the things that you've talked about, lotuses and the Guadalupe cucumber and prickly ash and ginseng. We learned lots of things. Thank you for being with us, Ben.
Yeah, no worries. Iowa's a really special place, and you know, all you got to do is look a little bit harder in places like this. You know,
you got to kind of get past the cornfields and the soybean patches, and there's There's still stuff there.
And the more folks that head out to Colorado, I say, the better.
That editorial comment.
Yes, we like to keep our population manageable, our human population.
Very
that
good.
Is, right? Don't tell
very
anybody
good.
How great it is here.
Oh,
thanks,
very
guys.
Good.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Well, I have a strange little news item I wish to share, just to kind of leave us on a note here. You find out the darndest things on the internet. I got this from the Common Dreams website. Oh, no, it's from The Guardian, theguardian.com. You can find it there. It talks about painting cattle with zebra-like stripes, and you wonder, why? Okay, find out if you picture yourself your black cow out there, and somebody went up and just kind of randomly made it look very much like a zebra with some white paint. A Japanese study has found out that painting a cow to look something like a zebra has been found to reduce fly bites by 50%.
Probably because the flies don't like zebras?
They don't like zebras. They bite everything, but the stripes screw up their vision,
evidently. Optical illusion. Oh,
they
yeah.
find of all the animals in Africa, zebras don't have, they have some. But not so much. Not so much. It screws up their observation. Optical illusion. Yeah. And flies can be a really bad thing. So people are experimenting. It works. It doesn't get rid of all the flies, but it works. And
they're for horses
actually,
too.
Also coming out with zebra striped horse blankets, and that seems to work. Isn't it? Now, see, this is a non-chemical solution.
Okay,
this,
now, if I wore zebra leggings, does that mean the mosquitoes wouldn't bite me?
We could. Now, this is biting flies. I don't know about mosquitoes. Well, we can try.
I'm much more concerned. Well, there are the no-see-ums. There are seasons might be important for human beings.
Huh? Well, so there's my silly news item. Paint your cow's legs zebras. I got that. That was forwarded to me from Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa. She kind of has heads
she's
up.
Their livestock coordinator. She's got her eyes open for that kind of news, right?
Look for that. Yes, sirree. You've been kind of finding a news item or
two. Oh, yes. I have one more news item. Starting on October 18th, some new tariffs were instituted on European products, like all the things we really love, the wine, some olive oils, many cheeses, some meats, a lot of the food imports that we do from the EU. So it covers it's a funny list because some places are hit more than others, but so it covers some German products, some Spanish products, some Italian, some French. And I think, well, we don't know if Britain is in the EU these days or not. We don't know if they're in or out. But so the tariffs have actually means there will be a 25% hike in the wholesale price, the price that they're brought
Ooh.
Into the country.
Ouch.
Now, this is a little, the purveyors of fine foods are a little concerned because, of course, it's coming right at the holiday, which is the time of year where they actually make enough money to stay in business. It's the big season coming. So most of them have stocked up in advance of the tariff because we knew it was coming. But that does mean that probably after the beginning of the year, some of those things will be much more expensive, and we will be buying more domestic cheeses, for example, because 25% is a rather significant price hike. And the funny thing is I was reading an interesting article where some poor cheese distributor was complaining. He said, this is happening not because our industry has done anything egregious. The origin of this tariff is because in the World Trade Organization, the European Union was accused of subsidizing Airbus. It comes from
Airbus.
Problems in the aeronautics industry. Now, and apparently also some other WTO considerations have come that Americans have also subsidized Boeing, perhaps, so you'd think these guys could go to the negotiating table amongst their airplane executives and work this out. But no, it's going to affect the price of our little delicacies in life. So
snarl.
Yeah, get it while you can, and, you know, then I guess we can start eating. We do have good domestic cheeses, and there are certainly plenty of domestic wines and wines from other parts of the world and other things, and, you know, it's just unfortunate.
Here we go.
Yeah, so if you're wondering why the price of some little delicacy that you love has gone up, it is because there is a 25% tariff now on these items.
Heads up at your local market. All right. Yes, you mentioned the holidays coming up. I've been noticing in the local paper and else, street signs and up in front of churches, this is the year of church craft sales. And my first thought is, Kringla, yes, Kringla. But this is a little cool, and all the church people start thinking of making Christmas decorations and have craft sales and cookie sales. I noticed there was a sign outside of the United Church of Christ on my way in here to the studio, and they're not just having something called a craft sale. They're having something called a holiday hoopla. So that might be
good marketing.
You have to kind of stand out.
It's not like going to Walmart or something. You'll find something that's handmade and unusual. Some nice gifty things.
There are people that still knit and crochet and embroider, and those kind of things are much appreciated. Mm-hmm. Yes, well, also coming up, Halloween. Halloween is coming up at Tricks and Treats and. Next week on the Diamond.
Oh, Lana, yeah. I want to beg you to make your, what was it? Your brown butter Rice Krispie treats.
Rice Krispie treats go well with Halloween. And, yes, brown butter Rice Krispie. It's on the Donna Lana Kitchen website, KHOI.
Right. It's basically you make your usual Rice Krispie treat recipe, but the butter that you put in, you brown it or almost burn it before. And it kind of makes that adult flavor
That's
to the whole thing.
That's a good treat. Yes, it is.
Yeah. And if you make them, only give me a limited amount because I could eat the whole pan of Rice Krispie treats. It's bad.
Duly noted.
Bad.
I'd like to mention, and here's another upcoming thing. This Saturday, October 26th, the Central Air Barn Dance is having a Halloween dance. Costumes are not required, but costumes are encouraged. You know how you get all dressed up for Halloween and then you go someplace and there's nothing to do but explain your costume. You just stand there. So if you come, you can dance in your costume.
Are you going as a cowgirl, Lana?
I don't know what I'm going to be yet. I have a whole box of stuff. The caller will be Reed Miller and the band will be Circle Right. We will have a good time. That is Saturday, October 26th. You can go to the Central Iowa Barn Dance Association Facebook page and find out more. And also coming up, the KHOI is having its fun drive starting November 6th. So, you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you Tuesday at noon, 7 p.m., or any time at khoifm.org about this music. This is a band called Four Shillings Short, and it's from their CD called The Boggy Spew. And that's one of the better names for a CD, The Boggy Spew. A lot of Irishy sort of things. Ah, Celtic, yes it is. Four Shillings Short. Eat good food and enjoy life.